Yeah, Professor Pattison, good morning again, and you are welcome. Can you hear me?
I can very faintly. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Good. I can hear you clearly, but it's quite faint.
Okay.
It's okay.
Okay. I just want to say that you are welcome again. Good evening. I think it is me by you. Good morning.
And it is, yes.
Thank you very much again. I think you can begin, please.
Good. Thank you very much. Right. I've been thinking about some of the questions that were asked yesterday. I'm very, very grateful for them. And part of the point of a process like this is to get new questions and to think about them. Not least, I've been thinking about the question of the relationship between philosophy and lived experience. Is the experience of the opening of the world in language, is that itself philosophy, or is philosophy reflecting on it? And philosophy is always in a certain proximity to life, but isn't confused with it. And that's something I'm going to go on thinking about. But today, I'm talking about the devout self. A few years ago, well, probably about 20 years ago, the philosopher Stephen Toulmin produced a book that was a kind of thought experiment in which he said, well, imagine if modern philosophy began with Montaigne. Montaigne's writings also represent a turn to the subject, but a very different kind of turn to the subject from Descartes, a much less rationalistic turn to the subject. I suppose my thinking about the devout life is a similar sort of experiment. What would it be like if, instead of beginning with Descartes, modern philosophy began with de Sales? Interestingly, of course, that they were contemporaries. They shared, to some extent, a common milieu. The bishop Berulle, who encouraged Descartes to set his thoughts down in writing, was also one of the patrons of de Sales. So in some ways, they're not very far apart culturally, but they present us with different views of the self. And as I emphasized yesterday, de Sales' approach to the self is a very practical one. He's concerned with helping people to live the devout life. Now, focusing on life in this way might seem to distance what I'm doing from traditional philosophy. However, it's now commonplace to say that in the ancient world, at least, in its beginnings, philosophy was very much about practice. Perhaps the writer who's done most to encourage this awareness is the French historian of ideas, Pierre Hadot, in his writings on Plotinus and the other ancient philosophers, is that these were not just, as it were, working in a laboratory. They were reflecting on how to live a good life. And the whole point of philosophizing was to live better, as in the Platonic Socratic view, that the task of philosophy is to prepare us for death. So the concern for knowledge was not abstracted from the process of how to live well. The same is true, of course, of their religious inheritors in the Middle Ages, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that they were philosophizing in order to help people to live better. Say philosophy doesn't take place in a laboratory, but we could say actually that the living human being is him or herself the laboratory in which philosophy goes to work. And of course, in the modern world, it's Kierkegaard is the name that springs to mind, who emphasized philosophy as dealing with the formation of the self. And this is a distinction he makes again and again and again, in contrasting the Greek way of philosophizing with the German way of philosophizing, or more specifically, Socrates versus Hegel. According to Kierkegaard, all the Greek philosophers remembered that they were human beings and that they lived under the conditions of finitude and mortality, that their thinking was not fantastical or exaggerated. Even all the differences of schools, Platonists, Aristotelians, Stoics, at least according to Kierkegaard, they all remembered this simple, basic, important truth. And of course, for Kierkegaard himself, famously coined the phrase, subjectivity is truth, versus Hegel, not the search for the objective truth about the world, but subjective truth. Now, interestingly for me at least, the Kierkegaardian self is not unlike the self that emerges from the devout life literature. Actually, this is not a surprise. Kierkegaard himself, biographically, grew up in what's called the Pietist tradition of Protestant Christianity. And the Pietists, too, were concerned with cultivating a certain kind of religious inwardness very similar to that of the devout school literature. In fact, they read, we know Kierkegaard read, both François de Sales and Fénelon. And the evidence of his journals is that he especially valued the writings of Fénelon. So it's no surprise that there is some similarity there. There are also differences. The Kierkegaardian self is famously a very individualistic self. He defined his task once as extracting the individual from the crowd, becoming fully individuated is what everything turns on, in a way, in Kierkegaard. Now, the devout self also is, in a sense, in a process of individuation, but it is never only an individual. Because, of course, very importantly for de Sales and Fénelon as Catholics, we are who we are through our participation in the larger religious community, for them, the church. Specifically, the way of devotion is a way that involves collaboration, working together between the individual and their spiritual director or their guide. The Kierkegaardian self is also, and I think this is also relevant to the devout self, is also a relational self in a certain sense. Very famously, near the beginning of The Sickness Unto the Death, one of his last books, Kierkegaard defined the self or defined spirit in terms of its self-relation. The self is a relation that relates itself to itself. It is not the relation, but that the relation relates itself to itself. What did he mean by this deliberately puzzling definition? In a way, it's simpler than it sounds. Traditional psychology taught that the human being is composed of body and soul. But what Kierkegaard is saying, that body and soul are in themselves just the raw materials. But the question is, the important question is, how they are to be related to each other. And it's this task of relating them to each other that is the task of becoming a self. And in a way, every one of us does this differently. We each have a certain bodily inheritance. We each have a soul. But then how do you bring these together? And crucially for Kierkegaard, these have to be brought together in such a way that the whole self becomes transparent to God, as he put it. Now, the other human being isn't absent from Kierkegaard's definition, but it isn't very obvious, let's say, that because I'm a bodily part of me is body, of course that immediately connects me to all other human beings. I'm born from my mother, I am looked after by my family, I'm dependent on others for food and drink. But this doesn't really seem very, very satisfactory. It gives only a minimum quality of relationship to other human beings. In fact, I think it falls short of Kierkegaard's own understanding of relation to others that we find in another of his works, Works of Love, where he talks about the obligation, the commandment to love one another as basic to not only to Christianity, but to human being human at all. So the devout life literature, however, remembers, so to speak, that this obligation to love the other is crucial and defining. Fenelon writes that if you're sitting at your prayers and then someone bursts into your room needing your help, you must, of course, immediately abandon your prayers and turn to help that other person. That the relationship to the human other is as fundamental as the relation to God. So the Kierkegaardian self, if you like, the existential self, and the devout self are similar, but not identical. Where they are very similar is that both of them are different, I touched on this yesterday, from the maximally autonomic self of modern secularism. The classic statement of this, of course, is Kant's little essay on what is enlightenment, where he says that we must free ourselves from being instructed by external authorities, whether it's the Bible, church, the king, or whatever. We must think for ourselves, and we must determine our actions according to what reason within us commands. Now, in Kant himself, of course, this takes a very rational form, that it is the principle of pure practical reason that is to guide our actions. But following Kant, in Romanticism and in other movements, this idea of autonomy was often much less rational. It was all about doing what you feel like doing. If you like, just the negative, don't let anyone else tell you what to do, don't let anyone else tell you how to be. The American essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson provided some very dramatic statements of this. Be true to yourself was the key maxim. And for Emerson, this was as much about feeling as it was about practical reason. Have no teachers, he insisted. Even a good teacher is going to be bad for you if you don't find your truth for yourself. We can say that not all, but much psychotherapy in the West shares this ambition. One of the great shapers of psychotherapy, Carl Rogers, writing in the 1950s, said that part of the task of psychotherapy is no oughts. Whereas for Kant, of course, the ought, what I ought to do, is absolutely crucial. For Carl Rogers, ought, the idea of ought is an obligation coming from someone else, and I shouldn't have any oughts, just what I spontaneously wish to do. And I think you could say that the turn away from religion in the West, particularly in the last 50 years or so, has to do with the perception of religion as being inherently heteronomic, that religion imposes alien demands on the self, that it restricts the individual's free life choices. In fact, it even denies the individual the right to make their own life choices. I could go on for a long time about this view of religion in the West, but I think you see it in popular culture, figures of religion in films or television programs are almost, not always, but almost invariably figures of authority, usually a very strict and irrational authority imposing their law on others. And of course, because people have become so ignorant of religion in the West, many people, I think, believe these caricatures to be true. In a way, the basic issue is already very clearly spelt out by Dostoevsky in the 19th century, one of the most radical statements in his knowledge, the possessed or demons, is the nihilist Kirillov. Some of you may know this novel. Kirillov has a plan to make himself God. His idea is that human beings have been held subject to religion throughout history because of their fear of death. And he says he's going to free humanity from the fear of death. How is he going to do that? He's going to do it by killing himself. This seems very strange. Of course, it is very, very strange. But his point is that he's not going to kill himself because he's depressed or because he's sick or for any reason, but simply to demonstrate the sovereignty of his free will over his life as a whole, that he himself has the right to take away his life. And as he sets it up, this is basically a battle of wills. He says, if there is freedom, either it's all on God's side or it's all on mine. Freedom can't be shared in any sense. So for him, it's a battle of wills, either his self-will or God's will. You can't have both. Now that, of course, is not Dostoevsky's own view, I should emphasize. People very often confuse Dostoevsky with his characters, which is a very big mistake, but it's a view that Dostoevsky understands and sets out. But is the devout self an unfree self? Is modern culture right in this judgment? And of course, only a careful reading of the evidence can give an answer, only a careful reading of the literature. And again, for me, this is the importance of, part of the importance of a phenomenological approach, that is close attention to worked examples and not to abstractions. So the question then is it possible to be both devout and free? Or is devotion the end of freedom? François de Sales' manual, An Introduction to the Devout Life, as I said yesterday, it's addressed to an imaginary reader called Philothea, she who loves God, and it begins with the line, you aspire, Philothea, to devotion. So the starting point of the book, the presupposition, if you like, is that Philothea desires devotion. She wants to become devout or wants to become more devout, to take her religion seriously. So it's clear that for de Sales, no devotion is not possible without an active desire on the part of the devout person. If that person doesn't themselves feel drawn towards devotion, what the French spiritual writers called an attrait, a being drawn. They must experience this themselves. Without that, you can't even begin. And as de Sales continues, he imagines that Philothea is wanting to become more devout. This is her desire. But does she really? And the first thing he does is set her a sequence of exercises to test whether this is really what she wants. And only when she's gone through this series of tests does he say, now you must make a formal act of commitment. So this is very much dependent, again, on this being really what she wants, and her calling is to be tested. What starts out perhaps only as an obscure feeling, something I want, but I can't really explain what it is, has to be developed through reflection. She has to think about it, and then she has to make an act of commitment, an act of will. Let's take a little drink of water. Now, a secular critic might say, well, that may all be true. May start out with her desire, her wish, but once she commits, she gives away her freedom. She subordinates herself to her spiritual director, to the authority of the church, even if, I mean, clearly in the case of a monk or a nun, that person enters their religious order, then they are subject to the rule of that order. They have to practice complete obedience. But the people for whom De Sales and Fénelon are writing are, for the most part, not monks or nuns. They're lay people living in the world. And I think that for them, freedom is a continuing quality of the devout life. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, it's an important part of the devout life literature is the importance of having spiritual direction, of having a spiritual director. Philothea doesn't become devout on her own. She does so with the help of a spiritual director. Now, especially in the eyes of a modern secular critic, this exposes the system to abuse, particularly. I think of what was said during the lecture on feminist philosophy of religion yesterday, when in many cases the spiritual director is male, the person being directed is female. The person directing is usually a priest, someone in a position of authority, and the person being directed is a lay person. So clearly, this is a situation that can easily lead to abuse. But, clearly this did happen. Clearly that relationship was abused in many cases. But that wasn't the ideal. The ideal was that this should be a dialogical process. Particularly if we read through the letters of direction that De Sales and Fénelon wrote to the people they were counseling. Again and again, the point is to find out what that person needs, what they want, that this should be a dialogical process and not simply a top-down process. And in some cases, this was very much a dialogue of equals. At an early stage in his career, De Sales met a woman, Jeanne de Chantal, who was a widow, who became the head of a religious house. They had an extended correspondence in many years and wrote to each other very much as equals. Sometimes in their iconography, they are shown side by side, as it were, as joint saints. And there are also cases where women did serve as spiritual directors, not only for other women, but also for men. So there are many, many variations, and we can't impose a single pattern to see this all simply as a pattern of heteronomic top-down indoctrination, if you like, would be a mistake. The evidence is the other, that the good spiritual director isn't trying to impose his will, but to discover, the word often used is discernment, to discern what's going on in the life of the devout person, the person being directed. What is their attrait? And very often, which I'll come back to, is they sometimes end up saying to the person they're directing, try to be less religious. You're not strong enough for this. You're not yet ready for this. You're not yet mature enough for this. Slow down. So there's the question of freedom. And as what I'm arguing is that the devout self is not an unfree self. It is a free self, but it's a free self that develops itself through a dialogical process of learning. But again, we come to the question of truth. The modern quest for autonomy is often represented as a quest for personal truth. I cited Emerson's "To your own self be true," that the standard of truth is simply yourself. And often in modern culture, this is connected to feelings. So what I feel is the truth of my existence. And from this point of view, the devout self can perhaps seem necessarily untrue. There is a perception that religion is always hypocritical because no one can be really authentically religion. Religion is imposed on us from the outside, therefore the religious self is always a false self. So not only do we have the question, is the devout self, can the devout self be a free self, can it be a true self? Again, I cite Kierkegaard's "Truth is subjectivity," and subjectivity he equated with passion. Now, this sounds like he might be saying much the same thing as Emerson, just be true to your own feelings. But I don't think so, because Kierkegaard distinguished, I think, the word passion can have different senses, different applications. We think of the passionate nature, someone who suddenly loses their temper, who becomes very angry, but then 5 minutes later, it's all over and they calm down again. That's not passion for Kierkegaard. For passion is something that has this quality of lasting and endurance, the kind of passion that drives a great artist or a great scientist, someone who shapes their life around one particular goal. Passion gives shape to life, it gives form, it gives a certain kind of wholeness through life commitment. One of the complaints of Kierkegaard against his own time, as he saw it, was that it was a time that lacked passion, that people just had interests that lasted for a day, a week, a month. They had no great passion. But is this enough for us to say that the devout self, that the self coordinated around a guiding passion to love God, is enough? We think of Augustine, one of the defining texts of Western spirituality, his Confessions, which begins with his account of the restless heart. Our hearts are restless till they find their rest in you. And later on, he has to say, here I am, Augustine, I love God, my life is the search for God. But then he asks himself, what do I love when I love my God? That here he is, he's launched in this process, he's reaching out for God, but he doesn't know what it is he's reaching out for. And that, in a sense, is the same situation as Philothea. She feels drawn to devotion. She has this feeling that she wants to be more devout, but she doesn't yet know what that means. She has to discover it. So what is it that she loves? And the answer of the devout life literature is that there is no easy answer. She can only get to find this through a long and often difficult practice. And it's interesting that, you know, one way of imagining this would be to think of someone setting out on a great task like climbing a mountain, climbing Mount Everest, having to get themselves ready to make the journey to the base and then the slow, difficult ascent. Of course, the image of ascending the mountain is one we find in many religious traditions. De Sales doesn't offer anything heroic like that. He compares it to recovery from sickness, getting better from sickness, and he says the slowest cure is the surest. We all know when we've been ill with influenza or something like that, we have 2 days in bed, and then we want to be back to work. We want to immediately get up from our beds and get back into the world, even though we know that's not a good thing to do, because then you often get ill again. The slow cure is the surest. But it's going to take a long time, it's going to take a lifetime, because it is the whole of one's life that is at issue, extending through time. And he also emphasizes that it's not only the future, it's not only your future you're committing to, one also needs to integrate the past. But because the human being is sinful, the relation to the past is different to the relation to the future. The relation to the past is repentance. The relation to the future is hope. Now, in a way that's, I think, different from Kierkegaard's self, the devout self is a social self, living in society and having to work out what devotion means in the context of its own social relationships. And in a sense, there is no rule book here. It has to take account of and react to others. Sahls supposes, he's probably right, that as soon as Philotheus' friends learn she wants to become more devout, they'll try to persuade her not to be so. They'll say, you don't want to make yourself into a religious maniac, you don't want to get too religious, just be a normal person, that's better. And as he says, once people know, they'll be prepared to be very critical of her. If she doesn't go dancing, they'll say, oh, she thinks she's better than everybody else, she's become a Puritan. But if she does dance, then they'll say, she's a hypocrite. So this complex life in society means that self-examination isn't just a matter of, as it were, examining her own feelings of what's going on inside her, as it were, but also of examining her social relationship. And this extends all the way down into language, that the dangers of social intercourse are, if you like, built into language itself. Now, we must remember that the time of de Sales was the 17th century in France, the time of the absolute monarchy, when an aristocratic society, when everything depended on power relationships, on patronage, on having someone, a patron, who will support you in your career, and an age of gossip, slander and flattery. The temptation to define yourself through your social role and your social status. And according to de Sales, a person who has no inner identity will constantly be following one or other social trend, will subject their own will to that of someone more powerful themselves. Of course, this is not unlike our own society in many respects. Now, there are two responses, perhaps, to this situation. One is the project, if you like, of self-will, the person who believes I am stronger than society, the person who can push through their own project in face of all opposition. Perhaps this is Nietzsche. At least it's how people have read Nietzsche. It may not be fair to Nietzsche himself, but we must make ourselves into supermen, into the Übermensch, or the American writer Ayn Rand. I don't know if she's someone who's read or known of in Iran, but she's a novelist and thinker who's been very influential on contemporary right-wing politics. And she believed very strongly that history is defined by great men who are superior to others, who push everybody else aside in order to accomplish their own goals. But Philothea, the devout self, is certainly not heroic in that way. She doesn't want to change the world or to rule over other people, but to transform herself. And the way to transformation is not reliance on her own self-will, like the heroes of Ayn Rand, or indeed like Dostoevsky's Kirillov, but on God. Then you might say, well, how does she know what God is asking from her, who God is, what God wants? And again, we have to go back to this process of direction, self-examination, and prayer. So against Cartesianism, also against German idealism and Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, the starting point is not the I, but a power or a ground of being outside of or external to the I, the conscious, rational ego. The basis of myself is not myself. Someone who saw this very clearly, I think, was the German theologian Friedrich Daniel Ernst Schleiermacher, whose famous definition of religion was the feeling of absolute dependence, that there is a certain level at which we are completely passive, kind of self-assertive, active self-affirmation to which other German idealists aspired, to which Nietzsche's Zarathustra would aspire, is not possible. There is a level of our being where we are purely receptive. Language of traditional religion, we did not create ourselves. And this is, of course, humbling. One can say that humility is the primary virtue of the devout life tradition. It's a way very traditional. Aquinas already says humility is the basic virtue. But this is something more radical than Aristotelian modesty, whereas an Aristotelian might take satisfaction, let's say, in a job well done. I build a boat. It's a good boat. I'm right to be satisfied with my work as a boat builder. But Philothea takes pride in nothing outside the God relationship. The only thing she can take pride in is what she receives as a gift from God. Now, this, of course, is a very difficult and challenging mental process. And from a certain point of view, it can be seen as a war against the self. Images of war are often found in the devout life literature, spiritual jihad, if you like. The idea of mortification, of putting to death the natural self-assertive desires of the self. There is an emphasis on tears and the necessity of tears, a focus on the wounds of Christ, on suffering and weakness and annihilation. In one of his most interesting writings, more theoretical writings, Fenelon offers a pastiche, if you like, of Descartes. He imagines himself setting out to doubt everything he can possibly doubt. But part of this is almost word for word taken from Descartes. And then he says, but I'm certain of this, that I'm thinking. So does this mean that I exist? He goes further than Descartes. He says, well, no, it's possible. I can't imagine it, but perhaps it's possible that there is a nothing that thinks. Perhaps that's what I am, a nothing that thinks. Not a being, but a nothing that thinks, that being comes only from God. Now, this denial of the self can, of course, as I mentioned before, lead to extremes of asceticism, people doing without food or whipping themselves, punishing themselves in all sorts of ways. But the evidence of the letters is again and again, don't do so much, you're not strong enough. Many of the people that they're writing to, typically very wealthy, aristocratic ladies, they want to give themselves totally to religion. And again they say, no, you're not strong enough, you're rushing in. This has to be taken very carefully, very slowly. The slow cure is the surest. That many of these people are like the sick person who's had 2 days in bed, and now they think they can go back to work and do everything they did before. But no, they have to take it slowly and carefully. There may be some people who are called to extreme asceticism, but they are very, very few, and they are exceptions, and you should only go down that way if that really is your attrait. The goal is not to punish yourself or to torture yourself, but to reach the point of what Fenelon called indifference, that is, indifference to one's own self-interest, to achieve a pure love of God where one loves God for God's sake. And I mentioned yesterday the way in which the figure of the woman with the bowl of smoke and the picture derived from Rabia al-Adawiyah entered into the Western tradition as well as a figure of this pure love of God. Fenelon added to this what he called the impossible possibility, a thought experiment. Imagine, he says, imagine that you are at the point of death. You know, 2 or 3 seconds of your life left. You know that you're just about to die. And you know with equal certainty that when you die, you will be consigned to hell, or perhaps just oblivion, totally cease. Would you still love God in that last moment? And he said, one could and one should be able to love God in that moment, because we don't love God for the sake of what gives it, God gives us, the rewards, or to fear, to avoid the punishments. We love for God's own sake, because God is lovable. And as I mentioned yesterday, this caused a huge controversy in France at the time, because the chief, the most important church figure at the court of Louis XIV, Bishop Bossuet, saw this as a direct assault, a direct attack on the whole way in which Christianity was understood and practiced in that society. Because for Bossuet, there was an exact parallel between the king and God. Both the king and the God ruling meant rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. And without a system of rewards and punishments, society would fall apart and no one would be interested in religion. So this, as I say, led to a very, very big quarrel. Interestingly, there's an echo of this also in Kierkegaard, in one of his well-known spiritual writings, known in English at least as Purity of Heart, a text which is a preparation for confession, for which the refrain, the motto, the leitmotif is purity of heart, is to will one thing. And according to Kierkegaard, the only thing that can be willed in this way is the good, because the good has a quality of unity that everything else lacks. So let's say if I have want an academic career in philosophy, then maybe I have to learn German. I have to acquire certain skills. I have to learn how to teach. I have to do many, many different things before I can qualify as an academic philosopher. If I want a happy marriage and family, then I need to get economic security. I have to find a home. All these things aren't single. They aren't unified. We have to do lots of different things. But we don't and mustn't will the good for the sake of something else, like success. We don't will the good in order to make friends, to improve our career, but simply because it is the good. Willing the good unifies the personality. And also, according to Kierkegaard, the possibility of willing the good is at odds. Well, this raises many, many questions. Is such a disinterested love of God really possible? Or is God always a part of some other agenda? And then again, also, what would such a pure love of God mean? How does that relate to the external practice of religion, for example? Is silent adoration the only way of expressing such a pure love of God? What happens to the whole language about God, to speaking about God? Does it mean there's nothing we can really say about God? Because language, after all, is always complex, is never entirely simple. One way forward, which I'll want to focus on tomorrow rather than today, is the idea of vocation, of calling. Because, as I said, when Philotheus starts out wanting to be devout, wanting to become, to take her religious seriously, she maybe doesn't really know what this involves. It's a feeling in her heart. She's drawn to it. In the same way, perhaps when we fall in love with a person, we can't say at first what it is we love about them. We're just drawn to them. Then through the process of direction, self-examination, and prayer, she discovers that actually this isn't her feeling. It is a call that comes to her from outside, a vocation, literally a calling, that she is being called by God to something. I think the importance of seeing it that way is that a calling is by definition a word event. It is something that happens in language that calls for understanding. So Boethia must not just be true to her feelings like the modern secular self. She must learn to understand what she is being called to, what this love of God he is being called to means. And that idea of vocation will be the theme of my next talk tomorrow. But thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. It was fantastic. And I think at least I have two questions. I begin with the first one, so then we will continue with other questions. In a certain part of this process that you explained about the devout self, you spoke about an instructor, but a good instructor, someone who does not instruct, but in form of a dialogue, help devout self to flourish herself. Here I see an epistemological problem. I want to know your idea about it or your explanation about it. Let us think that I am this devout self. And you are this instructor. You tell me that it is good for you that you do that or this. And I do not know if it is good or not. But I think that you are a good person. You want everything good for me. So in this way, you have a kind of power that I give it to you to say me what to do. But I cannot understand if it is good or not. I think it is the case in many of mystical initiations, mystical orders, that the initiated person does not know, but obey it because she thinks that it is good. So I want to know if you see this as a problem or not. And if you see that in this, to be a devoted self, kind of awareness of what I do is also important, or it is important that I freely want to do it.
Yes. I think I said in the talk that there clearly are examples of where this relationship went very, very badly wrong, and spiritual directors abused their authority or didn't have the right understanding, we might say the psychological or the spiritual understanding of what they were, of the people they were talking to really needed. And they encouraged people to do things that were very bad for them. Spiritually as well as emotionally, so it could go wrong. You know, everything human can go wrong. I think we know that. Nothing is risk free. But the aim again and again, I think, is not. It is that there is something Socratic in it to help the learner, the devout self, become. Their own, to build their lives on their own God relationship, in a sense, independently of the director. that it is a kind of what Kierkegaard called a meiotic relationship, a midwife relationship. And of course, incidentally, as a footnote, I mean, people like De Sales and Fenimore, they had a classical education. They were deeply educated in ancient thought and philosophy. So they understood about these pedagogical questions as well. One of the things I find interesting is that, as I mentioned, a lot of this, the literature comes through letters. And of course, sending a letter in 17th century France was not at all like sending an email. Today, it's not instantaneous transmission. It would take perhaps days for a letter to coming from Paris to reach the person at the other end who would then read it. Sometimes these exchange of letters are over weeks and over months. And I think that's important as well, because unlike in a monastic order, in this kind of spirituality, the person is literally on their own. They may be several hundred miles from their spiritual director. They can't send an email or pick up the telephone, but they have to be working this out for themselves. Someone yesterday asked about time. And I think that's important too. People had to have the time to work through these things themselves. One of the spiritual writers, de Caussade, talked about the sacrament of the present moment, that each particular moment has a particular task and a particular job. So one is getting the devout person to recognize what it is that they must be doing in just this particular moment, and maybe the spiritual director isn't there to help them, that they can, as it were, guide them, but they cannot dictate every step of the way. So it is, but one and the same time, in a way, it is a pedagogy of freedom, of helping the person to be living their own life with God, as it were, but it's also one of learning to accept dependence on another. I don't know if that, in a way, there is no theoretical answer to your question, because it can go wrong, but that's not what's being aimed at. And clearly some secular critics would say it can never go right, because it's basically a wrong relationship to have a director and someone being directed, that this offends autonomy, but I don't accept that. And a modern British spiritual writer, Ken Leach, writing in the 1970s, produced a very influential book called Soul Friend, thinking of spiritual director less in top-down heteronomic terms, but more in terms of friendship. And I think that's true of the best of the devout life literature. Okay?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. If you allow me, I will ask the second question. I missed a part of your explanation. You told that in some form of philosophies, for example, in Hegel, Schelling, and the other German philosophers like them, the source of life or the principle of reality stand beside our self. But I missed the part that you explained, how is the case in devout self? I missed it. Would you please repeat it in two, three sentences?
Okay, see if I can go back, look at my notes. And this might not be the exact point you were referring to, but I brought the German idealism and Cartesian into it in terms of the I, the ich, the ego being the starting point. One thinks of a rationalist deductive system of philosophy like Fichte, maybe less true of Schelling, But certainly Fichte, you know, the starting point is I equals I, the principle of absolute identity. And from this starting point of identity, Fichte then deduces the whole system of appearances of the world. And the assumption there is that there must be a single unified point of departure for consciousness. And for Fichte, incidentally, of course, that I is a productive I. It is an active I, a bit like the medieval idea of God as actus purus, pure activity. The I that produces itself, the cause of itself. So whereas for the medieval thinkers, of course, this was God and only God was the actus purus. For Fichte, this is the quality of consciousness as such. And I think it's very hard in Fichte's case to distinguish between the human being, the human mind, and the mind of God. But there doesn't seem to be a real difference. Contemporary with Fichte is Schleiermacher, who says, well, no, we never achieve that kind of self-activity. There is always a dimension of our being. The basis of our being is something we receive. And I think, you know, that the self is active-passive. It can never just be purely active. It is active-passive. And I think that's important, that the principle of unity and the principle of dialogue, that there is a striving towards unity, unification is, if you like, a necessary tendency of consciousness and life. But reduction to the principle of identity is perhaps reduces life, makes life less rich, less full than it is. So the principle of identity requires the complement, the addition of the principle of dialogue. The fundamental principle is not just one, but is dialogical, which relates to perhaps to what I'll say about language tomorrow as well. Was that the part of the talk I was you were asking about?
I think so. Thank you very much. One of my colleagues, Professor Akrami, has also a question.
Thank you, Dr. Isfahani, and hello, Professor Patterson. I hope I'm not going to bother you with long comments and questions and maybe relevant and obscure ones, but...
I'm sure not.
Thank you. I have a general sympathy with the kind of talk that you have been sharing with us on the devout life. And it's very interesting, and I'm struck by the similarities between our two traditions. The tradition you are sharing with us is derived from, obviously, Christian tradition, and particularly de Sales' writings. I'm very much also familiar with the Islamic mystical tradition, particularly Rumi and Ibn Arabi and others. And I can find very striking similarities between the two traditions. Emphasis on a spiritual director is interesting. And many, many other things like passion in Kierkegaard, which is actually for Maulana the key for any kind of spiritual nourishment and flourishing. All through the whole process of spirituality, one needs to be always and always motivated by thirst. This is the kind of simile or analogy that Maulana very much likes to use throughout all his writings. A thirst, which is the driving force of any spiritual man or woman. Also, indifference of one to one's interest. That's a very interesting and important step to take and achieve on the spiritual path. And many, many others, the purity of the heart, again, by Kierkegaard, that kind of emphasis. All these are very interesting and important qualities that one needs to develop on the devout life or the spiritual life or the mystical and funny life that we have in the Islamic tradition. So I can expand on this further, but I do not want to take time, your time, and the precious time of others. But a couple of perhaps questions. One question is this. You were talking about, again, on Kierkegaard, you were talking about subjectivity being his kind of definition of the truth being subjective. I remember reading a very interesting book. You might have read it. The title, as far as I remember, is Truth and Dialogue, which is an edition of, or rather proceedings of a conference held perhaps in 1980s in the United States, where John Hick and Cantwell Smith and many other prominent scholars of religion and philosophy of religion participated. That's a very interesting book. And perhaps it was edited by John Hick himself. So Truth and Dialogue. The interesting point that I want to make a connection between what I found there and what you said on subjectivity being the truth, according to Kierkegaard, is the following. In that conference, again, the paper is there in the book, Wilfred Cantwell Smith has a presentation, and the title is, as far as I remember, A Personalistic View of Truth, which might have been or should have been very striking to many participants and scholars in that conference or symposium or whatever it was. Because mostly when we think about truth, we think about truth as something objective, something not relative, not personalistic, not personal, something apersonal, something there for everyone and for all the time and for all the spaces and so on and so forth. But here, Smith is particularly concerned with the question of religious truth. And for him, religious truth is not of that type of abstract, objective truth out there, but rather something personal. So, for example, he says that someone asked me yesterday, am I a Christian? I said, no, I'm not a Christian now, but I was a Christian yesterday when I helped my neighbor. So the truth becomes... So you need to appropriate the truth and make it your own personal quality or something like that, which goes very, very perfectly well along the lines of definition of truth according to Kierkegaard. But the interesting thing is that in that very conference, John Hick asks Cantwell Smith this interesting question, whether or not this subjective truth should be already as an objective truth that now has become personalistic or subjective. So the whole difficult question arises here as to how to make the connection between the subjective truth and the objective truth, which is a very obviously complex philosophical question. Mm-hmm. I would like you to comment on this, and I would like myself to see how you react to this kind of question, which is a very interesting one. Obviously, Dick was not opposed to that kind of personalistic view, but he asked that kind of question, in which is interesting in itself. Another thing that I wanted to ask, actually, this could have been and perhaps should be a very interesting topic for our next conversation or in another context, because in our department, we are basically doing philosophy of religion. Maybe this is less related to philosophy. It is more related to this kind of religious life, devout life, a spiritual, mystical life. And maybe we can do a kind of comparative study of the devout life in Christianity and Islam next time. But one thing which makes this whole project of devout spiritual life connected to philosophy is that many people in today's world, for theoretical, philosophical, scientific, and cultural reasons and causes on the one hand, and also for practical reasons and causes on the other, quite increasingly find a devout life difficult for themselves. And I'm sure you know much better than me on these two kind of types of hindrances to spiritual life, theoretical, scientific, cultural on the one hand, and these practical obstacles. How are we to overcome them? How are we to make a spiritual life easier? considering these problems. So one needs to address these problems and find proper solutions for them. At least you can enlighten us in your next presentation tomorrow in the light of this question. There were other things that I wanted to also share, ask, or share as my comments, but I do not want to take more time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll comment briefly, at least on both of those. And regarding first, while you were talking, I thought of what I mentioned in the lecture about Augustine, who starts off his confessions with this desire, with his restless heart. Indeed, I'm sure Augustine too uses the imagery of thirst, as found in the biblical Psalms. My soul is longing and thirsting for you, O God. But then he says, yes, but what is it I'm looking for? So perhaps like John Hick, he also wants the objective as well as the subjective. It's the subjective that gets him started, but then there is also an objective question in there. In terms of Kierkegaard, you used the word appropriate. In fact, appropriation is a very important word for Kierkegaard, that one of his problems, as he sees it, is he lives in this society in Denmark in the 19th century, and you could say 99% of the population belong to the Danish National Church. Unlike other European countries, there isn't an alternative Christian minority. There are effectively, you know, maybe two dozen Jews and perhaps no Muslims. It's a very unified religious culture, and everybody in Denmark is baptized into the church, confirmed into the church, is buried by the church, is a member of the church. But Kierkegaard sees it, they haven't appropriated the meaning of Christianity. The form of Christianity is there, but it doesn't mean anything to people. It is, as it were, just a social habit. Now, he doesn't want to get rid of Christianity, of course, as some secular contemporaries of his did. But he says, well, here it is. Here is this body of teaching. The task is to appropriate it, is actually to live it. And nobody is doing that. And that's what we have to start doing. More in a more focused way, he gave some interesting lectures about ethical, well, he never gave the lectures, but he wrote notes for lectures on ethical and religious communication. And he said one of the differences between, say, Socrates, a pure Socratic teaching, and Christian teaching, I think the same would count for Islamic or Jewish or other religious teachings, is that nevertheless that there is a certain factual claim at the start. Most of the work is about the subjective appropriation of making this teaching true in your own life, in your own personal life. But there is nevertheless always this element in Christianity, of course, the claim that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That's, as it were, the objective claim on which you build. But yes, I think in some ways, though, I would personally prefer a mediating term like intersubjective before we go to objective, because what the objective claim is something we work out in through thinking, and we think in language, and language is a co-product. It's something we do together. So as opposed to, let's say, the kind of secular Emerson-like view is where I just have my feelings and I'm true to my feelings. That's the only thing that matters to me, no matter what anyone else thinks. I think in a religious way of life, we are committed to working out together what it is we're striving to achieve, what it is we're striving to do. I'll perhaps leave it there for just now. But yes, there has to be a struggle for clarification of what is this unifying context. But I don't think that what, if you like, has the character of facts in the way this is understood, at least in a certain kind of positivism. The difficulty of starting on the devout life, it's one of the features of contemporary Western life is that although there's a massive falling away from religion, massive secularism, that at the same time there is a massive growth in spirituality. And again in the West, you meet people who say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And many people who will say they don't believe in God, they don't believe in any traditional doctrine, or they don't know if they believe in God, but would say that they're on some kind of spiritual path. Now, very often, this will turn out to be influenced by Buddhism, perhaps, or by a very Western version of Buddhism. This huge growth in the last 20 years in mindfulness as a practice, which may or may not have any religious, it may be a purely secular form of mindfulness, but nevertheless, it is some kind of spiritual discipline. So there is a lot of, this is another part of the context for my own work on the devout life, that there is a lot of interest in spirituality, in finding an alternative way of living to the very pressured, very competitive way of living that characterizes the West today, that creates a lot of social fragmentation, that creates a lot of stress and mental health problems in individuals. And I think, in fact, my wife and I were talking about this yesterday, that, you know, whenever we listen to the radio, somebody is talking about mental health, and many of the mental health problems that people report today, I think in the past were dealt with by people's participation in religion. But if people don't pray, they're not sharing their internal problems and their feelings and their questions with anyone, and these things just build up and generate stress. For example, life is no longer structured by shared rituals in the same way, and people are thrown back on their own resources. All of this creates stress and tension and dissatisfaction. So I think many people are looking for something. They're worried about traditional religion because, as I say, this is so widely seen as heteronomic, that you have to surrender your freedom, you have to surrender your own personal truth in order to be religious. I think that's a misunderstanding, but I have to accept that it's what many of my contemporaries think and believe. So looking at the devout life tradition, I think, is finding a way of being religious that resonates with the contemporary aspiration to spirituality and does not involve the kind of heteronomy that my secular contemporaries are very worried about. Nevertheless, it certainly does, at a certain point, require us to acknowledge the limits of our own freedom, our own self-activity. It does require humility, which is a very non-modern kind of virtue. There.
Thank you again. I think we can close session. Tomorrow we will continue the discussion. I was grateful. I must say that I enjoyed it really. The both answers you have given, that was very good.
I'm having difficulty hearing you at the moment.
Excuse me, I just thank you much. And I told that we will see you tomorrow again, and we will discuss further.
I look forward to it. Since we began, the end of my lecture tomorrow will be slightly different, so I will send a revised summary of it before I begin tomorrow, but mostly the same.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We will begin in about hour, 15 hours, 13 hours. Thank you very much.
Thank you.